and Security Council authorization for a war against Iraq. But diplomats said the Bush administration is not likely to push the resolution to a vote until well into the first week of March, after another report from U.N. weapons inspectors. Meanwhile, the U.S. and Turkey are still billions of dollars apart. The Bush administration has proposed $6 billion in outright grants, as well as U.S. government backing for up to $20 billion in loans in exchange for giving the U.S. access to military bases for an invasion of Iraq. Turkey is demanding more than $30 billion in assistance, weighted more heavily with grants. Oakland City officials have agreed to pay nearly $11 million and to implement reforms to settle civil rights lawsuits brought by more than 100 people who charged they were victimized by a group of police officers known as the Riders. The lawsuits allege the officers kidnapped and beat suspects in the summer of 2000. The 119 plaintiffs said the city and police department encouraged or ignored the abuse. Some of the changes proposed for the Oakland PD include establishing a hotline to report police abuse and internal affairs investigations. An outside monitor will be named to a 5-year term to ensure the reforms are implemented. 3 former officers are on trial on charges they beat suspects and falsified police reports. A 4th officer fled to escape prosecution. The legislature's budget analyst says Governor Davis's plan to raise $8.3 billion in income sales and tobacco taxes will not adequately fund his proposal to shift billions of dollars in state programs to local government. Analyst Elizabeth Hill said the taxes sought by Davis would grow at a somewhat lower rate than the programs local governments would administer. Hill also proposed an early release for nonviolent prisoners who are 55 years or older and a delay in building a new death row at San Quentin. Over 200 healthcare workers at the San Jose Good Samaritan Medical Group staged a 1-day strike against what they call an attempt to roll back worker seniority and quality patient care. Hospital officials say they want physicians to make staffing decisions based on patient need. The walkout resulted from an impasse in contract negotiations between the Service Employees International Union Local 250 and the San Jose Good Samaritan Medical Group. The American Civil Liberties Union and other groups are using an unusual legal maneuver to challenge the government's spying authority. They filed a Supreme Court appeal on behalf of people who don't even know they're being monitored. The ACLU argued that a review court misinterpreted the Patriot Act, making it too easy for the government to get permission to listen to telephone conversations, read email, or search private property, then use the information in criminal cases. I'm Eileen Alfandary. More on these and other stories on the KPFA Evening News at 6. Be sure to stay tuned now for Flashpoints.
On Flashpoints, our special correspondent Anne Gwynn shot in Nablus during an ambulance rescue mission. Also, a report from Gaza where Israeli tanks and helicopter gunships killed a dozen Palestinians. A 4th-generation shrimp boat captain locks down for peace in front of the United Nations. And we'll hear children's voices for peace and excerpts of a Pacifica anti-war documentary. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. These days, I brace myself before I check my phone messages. More often than not, there are messages from the West Bank and Gaza, messages about the latest brutalities of illegal Israeli occupation. Today, the familiar voice on the other end of the shaky long-distance phone line was that of Anne Gwynn's. Anne, a 65-year-old grandmother from Wales, is now a special Flashpoints correspondent, riding an ambulance through the West Bank, narrating the latest violence from the occupied territories. That's Palestine. Today, this courageous truth teller was shot by an occupying Israeli soldier for trying to rescue a Palestinian child who was gunned down while throwing rocks at Israeli tanks. Even the bullet in her leg did not stop this outraged elder from telling the world what was going on under the iron fist of Israeli Prime Minister and accused mass murderer, Ariel Sharon.
Tuesday, 10:29 p.m.
Okay, this is Anne, 059-376-232 in Nablus. I called you a little earlier. We're actually waiting to find a way around now to where people have been injured. Actually, it's not a gun battle. I'm sorry, I don't know how on earth one uses these terms. It's actually Israeli soldiers firing on children who are throwing stones. Many soldiers. It's in the old city. It's just at the entrance of the old city. It's between two schools. And as we walked up the road, we were fired on by a tank. Firas shouted, "Stop, stop, it is international." And I shouted, "Stop, stop, it is ambulance driver." Every tank swung its cannon, its huge 80-millimeter cannon, towards us as we walked up the road. That's pretty scary. Okay, I'll call you later if there's any update.
Tuesday, 11:04 p.m.
Okay, Dennis, I'm now in the main city square, the Medan Al Hussein. We are actually pinned down now. We have failed to reach the injured, but we are pinned down with a tank to our right, which is some 30 feet away. I can see down the cannon barrel. It's 80-millimeter barrel. And to the left, we have a Hammer and APC. We are completely pinned down. The square is full of extraordinarily brave taxi drivers.
End of message. Tuesday, 11:06 p.m.
Okay, I just wanted to finish that bit about the taxi drivers. Their screens are covered with bullet holes. Their rear windows are shot out. They are in, I can see now, eight around the Midan here, just ferrying terrified women, children, old people to safety. And they are a prime target for the gunner who is operating the gun in the turret, sorry, the turret gunner in the tank. I'll sign off now because it's not a good place to stand between the tanks and the APC. Okay, our ambulance has just arrived to the left to pick up another injured youngster. I will call you back.
Tuesday, 11:22 p.m.
Dennis, I would so much like Americans to hear this fire, but I just missed the last volley at a group of children because I want American citizens to know what their tax dollars are buying these huge 25-millimeter bullets. The cannon bullets, 80 millimeters out of the tank, every kind of sniper bullet, armored car bullets. One has been killed already this morning, and it's Nasser Abu Safir. Safir was killed this morning. There are injuries. You know, please, U.S. citizens, for God's sake, phone the White House, phone the Capitol, call your representative. This is your money that is being shot at here at children. They are like up to my waist, up to my shoulder. For God's sake, Americans, protest.
12:43 a.m.
Dennis, this is Anna Nablus. I have just been shot. Faras has just been shot again in the leg. I am holding a young man who has been shot. I was... His name is Khaled. He is weeping. He is very afraid. We were going to a house to rest, to bring out a woman who is about to deliver a baby. And they simply shot me in my leg and Firas in his hand as we were going to the house. We have nothing. He is an ambulance driver. I am 65. My God, U.S. citizens, this is what your tax dollars are doing. Shooting. Oh, my God. My God. Shooting old people and ambulance drivers and pregnant women. And now the tank is coming. Sorry, I'm going to take cover. I mean, this is a nightmare. Americans, get out there and protest about this. Just outrage. This is an outrage.
Hello.
Back. 12:47 a.m.
No, Britannia. Oh, I'm from Britain. Dennis, I don't know whether you got that in the confusion, whether I pressed the right number. Did you get it? I'm going to repeat it briefly. So I was just shot in the leg by an Israeli soldier. I was going to take out a pregnant woman from a house who was in labor with Firas, the hero ambulance driver. He was also shot in the hand again. They've taken him to hospital. They didn't notice I'd been shot. It's fine. It's not a problem. I tried again to go around the corner to get this woman in labor out, and they've shot at me again. I mean, you know, I am 65. I have gray hair. I'm clearly an international. So here we have a new situation where, for the first time, they are shooting at a British citizen, and, you know, quite freely. I mean, this is just a nightmare. This is just a nightmare. I'm going to go.
1:05 a.m.
Oh, Dennis, sorry. It's so tense here. This is me. We are trying to negotiate the fetch the pregnant woman where we were shot before. The same soldiers, unfortunately, pointing guns. They are threatening to shoot us again. This time we do have some international, not just for us and me. Yes, yes. Okay, and we're going to attempt to walk. It's a very narrow alley. They have a total view of us, of course, because they are shooting from the occupied house. They are shooting down the alley. It's just in their own land. The woman pregnant cannot get a hospital to deliver her baby without shooting an ambulance driver and a 65-year-old. It's pretty unbelievable.
1:20 a.m.
Dennis, hi. I just wanted to just give you an update. We're standing in an alley. Faraz has come from the hospital. He with his doubly bandaged hand, now two bullets in the same hand. I could have wished it was the other hand, then he'd be out of this. He's holding the stretcher. We are side by side with Susan from Seattle. We are facing the soldier who is actually looking down his gun sight at us, the one who shot us before. It's really amazing to see this young man actually threatening the lives of so many people. A stretcher with an ambulance driver holding the front of it, me standing by his side, Susan standing by my side. It's just ludicrous. It is absolutely ludicrous. There's been much shooting behind us, and we've asked for permission to move. Faraz speaks fluent Hebrew, and he's negotiated with him, and his only answer is no. And we have shown that we have nothing. We have our hands in the air. We've turned round. We have shown we have nothing, that we're just ambulance crews. And he refused everything.
Said to him, what's
up? What's up? Yeah. You know his
number?
Oh, who do you want? Yeah. Mustafa? Yeah. I got Mustafa's number here. We're going to call Dr. Mustafa Rakhouti. I call Dr. Mustafa now.
2:29 a.m.
Okay, did I tell you about the pregnant woman we were trying to get out? We finally got her out under fire from two sides. But I really wanted you to hear this, and of course they've stopped. They were shooting the big cannon from the tank, which is just an unbelievable noise, and I really tried to get it for you, but at this moment, how many? They're not shooting it, okay. Okay. I'm just getting a cup of shakhlab, which is a milk drink, because we've had nothing today yet. We have now been here for how many hours is it, Dennis? I think 5 hours. And I will let you know if anything significant transpires.
End of message.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. You just heard Anne Gwynn, our special correspondent in the West Bank, after she was shot trying to rescue kids and get a pregnant woman to the hospital. We continue our coverage of the Israeli expanding occupation of the West Bank and Gaza as they turn up the heat and using the proposed war against Iraq. Many Palestinians feel to totally reoccupy Gaza and perhaps purge the entire region of Palestinians. We're joined again by Amani. She works with an NGO helping women start businesses. Amani, welcome back to Flashpoints. First of all, when we spoke to you last night, there was gunfire out your window. It would be about an hour or so before Israeli tanks, helicopter gunships, bulldozers moved into Gaza. It's reported now that at least 11 people were killed. Several of them were crushed by those bulldozers. What can you tell us about the Israeli invasion and attacks?
Yesterday, as you mentioned, while I was talking to you, they start coming to Gaza. They came to the east side of Gaza, an area called Shija'iya. It's the center of Gaza City. A lot of bulldozers, Israeli tanks, they just came in. After a while, we heard a big explosion. We knew later that it is a Palestinian guy who exploded himself in front of one of these tanks. It was a suiciding action. After that, they continued the clashes at that area. At the same time, they came from the north to another city north of Gaza, Jabalia town, and there they started coming a lot of tanks again. They put some explosions inside one of the houses there, where there was, down of this house, there was a workshop. They exploded this house and another laundry, which is close to this house. Everything, or they boasting that two brothers and another neighbor, they just came out to see what's going on, but it seems that they didn't continue the explosion, so they were out. So three were dead just because they went out to see what's going on. Another three, they were from the Palestinian Authority, from the police. They were sitting in their car, and their rule was supposed to forbid any of the other Palestinians who were trying to throw any mortars to the Israeli sites. They were part of, let's say, the liaison officers or those who are trying to help to stop such events. But these three were killed by a rocket from the airplane from Apache, which was just at that area at that time.
So the Israelis shot at the three Palestinian cops who were trying to control the crowd and stop the violence, and they got killed for that.
Exactly, yes. They were asked by their officers to stay, just to stay in their car, and they were shot by this rocket. The others were killed during the clashes. The other people who were died, they were, and during the resistance. There was a bit of resistance by the Palestinians when the Israelis tried to come to the area. As I heard also from the news and from the people, that they were not able to get out of their tanks. They were just moving in their tanks and with bulldozers, and they were not able to get out of it. And they continued the clashes, different and many workshops around the area. Plus also they hit a school, an elementary school, just at the same area. It was hit, not serious damage, but it was hurt. And as a result, of course, these students, they were not able to go to their school today. They were afraid that they might continue any time. After that, they spent around 5 hours. All this operation continued for 5 hours. Of course, from time to time, you keep on hearing the Apache, the bulldozers, the explosions, and all these different kind of weapons they used during this invasion. Today, in the morning, of course, all the funerals came to bury the bodies, the dead bodies, and there was a strike. All the shops were closed, plus all the students did not go to their schools. Most of the schools around, they were also on strike. The other thing today, 5 hours from now, they closed Gaza City. I mean that no one can go to the south of Gaza. No one can reach the middle camp, middle of Gaza Strip, either the south. The beach road which lead to the middle camps is completely, the Israeli announced that it is closed till further notice. And as a result of that, of course, all the people who were trying to go back home after their work or after visiting friends or whatever, they were not able to go out to their houses. And of course, a lot of them, and I know a friend of mine, she's a mother of two kids, and she was just here to take a computer lesson, and she was not able to go back to her kids. And she stayed in Gaza with another friend. And of course, many, many others were not able to go, and they just came back to Gaza City and tried to find a place to spend overnight. Till now, we don't know when this will be open again.
Palestinian leadership is saying that what they believe the Israelis are doing are trying to sort of kill off the leadership and take as much land back as possible, occupy as much territory before there's any kind of peace agreement. Is that what it seems to be on the ground there?
It seems this, yes. They are either by reoccupying or by just taking it and build different kind of sieges and walls and all this stuff. And they don't care about if they demolished houses, if they asked people to leave their homes or whatever. They moved gradually, meter after another.
And let me ask you finally, Amani, there is a lot of resistance now. The Israeli spokespeople are saying, well, the problem is that these Palestinians go out and they have guns, and when you shoot at Israeli soldiers, you can expect that the Israeli army will kill them. Why are people out in the streets? Why is there resistance now?
The resistance is only when the Israelis are in. And of course, it is as a human, anybody who has someone is trying to attack or to come, they will resist. If they have guns or even if they don't have guns, they will resist. And that's what's going on now. I think it's the very normal reaction towards what they are doing, towards what the Israelis are doing. They are coming and then the people are out in the streets to resist. They are not just out walking in the street and start shooting or whatever for no reason. No, it's as a result of the attacks, the Israeli attack.
If you could tell the American people, if you could speak to all of them at once, because they don't hear a lot about what's really going on, how would you explain the situation?
We are under occupation. I remember since I was a child, it's occupation. It's Israelis everywhere, and we are under occupation. And this is our land, and we want it back. So the resistance continue, and the fight or whatever, or even the negotiations and all such issues is to give our land back, to have our own state. This is in brief the situation. So I think it is very basic right of the human beings or any nation to fight, to find the peace, to find the land, to find very peaceful situation for us, for our kids, for the coming generation. And this is what continued during all the life of the Palestinians.
All right. Amani works with an NGO. She helps women to start businesses. Of course, all of that is very difficult in the face of ongoing expanding occupation, colonization, and violent settler movement. Amani, we're going to stay with you on this. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoints.
Welcome.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Diane Wilson is a fourth-generation shrimp fisherman who was galvanized into activism when she discovered Dow Chemical dumping dioxin into the Gulf of Texas. She has since fought tirelessly to clean up her beloved Texas oceans and has gone to Bhopal, India, to stand up for the Union Carbide Dow victims there. She has just returned from Baghdad, where she went to show solidarity with the Iraqi people. And in fact, she's just back from New York City, where she was arrested at the United Nations. She was supposed to be a part of our national teach-in last weekend, but she ended up with handcuffs on. Diane Wilson, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Well, I'm sure glad to be here.
Well, it's good to have you. Well, you were arrested at the United Nations. Could you tell us exactly what you were doing when you were arrested?
We were there about 9:30 in the morning, and it was right before there was to be a major speech at the UN. We wanted to be there with the Code Pink women. It was a delegation of women that had also been to Baghdad, and we were all dressed in pink, and I was done out in the whole American flag because I feel it is truly patriotic to question what the government is doing, and it is very American to dissent and speak your mind. That's what freedom of expression, freedom of speech is. So it was 9:30, and there is a gate that surrounds the United Nations. It's right where you have all those series of flagpoles with the United Nations flags. I went and climbed the fence just as the other Code Pink women. We all had coats and ponchos covering our pink outfits. I took off my poncho and climbed the fence, and immediately I had a pair of chains that I had locks on, and so I locked myself on top of the gate, and there was the women started chanting No Blood for Oil and started just chanting different versions of no war and that we were opposed to the war.
So you locked yourself to the fence there at the United Nations, and then did they come and cut you down?
Well, they kind of stood around for a little while. I was actually amazed how long we got to stay there. Not too long ago, Medea Benjamin and myself, we had been in front of Donald Rumsfeld as he was giving a speech before the Service Arms Committee to talk about the war in Iraq and why we should invade. And I was amazed then, too, about how long you can actually stand there and either disrupt something or stand up on a fence and be there. And so we were actually there quite a long time, and there was cops all over the place, and they kind of came up to us and kind of looked at us, and then they'd say, "Hey, you, get down from there." I know I had a couple of them come and examine my chains and then say, "Yep, she's chained there." And here come a supervisor, and he'd say, get that woman down from there, and they'd say, she's chained. Matter of fact, like I said, we went through about four versions of No Blood for Oil, and Medea Benjamin even ended up giving quite a lengthy speech in front of, I bet you there was 15 cameras, and I don't know whether the police allowing us to stand there and them taking so long to get me down, whether it was because the cameras were standing there or whether that's just their normal way.
Well, I know that was your fourth arrest. I know that the police in Washington were less gentle, if you will. You're learning a lot about the way in which poor people are treated in these prisons, and we can talk to you about that another time. But you also were just back from Baghdad. Was it what you learned in Baghdad and the experience that has now led you to be more militant and more active? Tell us about what you're learning and why you're choosing to do these kinds of actions and put yourself at risk.
The most important thing I learned when I went to Baghdad is it put a face on the people. I found out how truly poor they were. I remember going across the border, and this is the main border, you know, an international border, a sovereignty, that type of stuff. And we went across that border into Iraq, and it was so poor that man was sweeping kind of like the bricks around the where you have to go in and get your visas checked and all that. He was sweeping it with a broken off broom. They did not even had a hose for water, so he would fill up this kind of water bottle with water and he would pour it over the steps. This was only a repeat of everything I saw. You know, it took 10 hours to cross the desert. And so, you know, the people that are going to be bombed in Baghdad, most of them are very poor. I think the teachers make like $6 a month. So these people aren't going to be leaving Baghdad. They aren't going to be moving. And you got 10 hours across the desert. So if they start bombing, they are going to be bombing children, because half the population of Baghdad and of the population of Iraq is children under 15. I remember seeing on the news before I left, and I believe it was Colin Powell, and he was talking about the intense urban fighting where these troops will be going into the streets of Baghdad. And we went back there because we were a large majority of the people are only subsisting on government handout. I think there's 60% unemployment. So these people are getting the bare minimum. I mean, we're talking sugar, we're talking salt, we're talking soap, you know, like protein, eggs. They don't get that type of thing. So here you have these terribly defenseless people, and you're going to have troops going into those streets, and it's going to be children that they're leveling. And I guess that was what astounded me, because all I hear on TV is what a threat in that Iraqi people are the enemy. These are the terrorists, and all I found was this terrible poverty. I found these very defenseless people. They were extremely open and friendly, and they had the generosity of a spirit that they could differentiate between the American people and the American government. And, you know, and I don't think America has that much generosity of spirit, because, you know, when I came back from Baghdad, I had a bus driver in Texas that drove me to where my truck was parked in the parking lot, and he was just saying, we got to level Baghdad. We got to make a parking lot out of it. And it's like they do not even put faces on that. They don't even begin to question, to even doubt what is being said. And I just guess what that has made me is even more willing to stand out there to push the envelope. And because while I was there in Baghdad, we went to the bomb shelter that was bombed in 1991, and it was by two Scud missiles. And I guess that experience of seeing that must be what it's like for people who walk into these camps that was a part of the Holocaust, because that was so nerve-wracking to see blood all over the floor, to see the imprints of bodies that were burned, incinerated in the blast. And then I believe even downstairs, because it was so awful. They don't